Hello, listeners. Jordan here. I just want to let you know that you can listen to Nighttime early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back. Tonight's episode, I'm going to tell you right up front, is going to be difficult. We're going to hear both the story of a young life lost and the battle that his loved ones have waged for answers and accountability. This is going to be the kind of story that makes you clench your fist in frustration. We're going to be focusing on a tragic event that played out at a Nova Scotia power dam near Sheet Harbor in October of 2020. Then 26-year-old civil engineer Andrew Nasdowski and a co-worker were on site completing a survey of the water body's floor. However, a technological failure would soon disrupt their work and result in Andrew making the fateful decision to enter the water to collect a piece of equipment. Moments later, Andrew, a strong swimmer, would be yelling for help before ultimately disappearing below the still water. In the year since Andrew's tragic death, the Nasdowski family have been steadfast in their belief that the investigation into Andrew's death has been flawed at best and completely compromised at worst. And it's not just a hunch that's telling them that. Nearly every step of the way, it seems that Andrew's number one advocate, his sister Nicole, has been uncovering the kind of details that make a public inquiry the only logical outcome. We have conflicts of interest, erroneous death records, the scrubbing of online records, bureaucratic flip-flopping, and of course, opportunistic politicians. This episode is going to take us through all of that. So let's get into it. Tonight, in this episode of Nighttime, we're going to be joined by Nicole Nasdowski. And our topic is the search for answers and accountability related to the death of her brother, Andrew Nasdowski. So just before we get into the story, why don't you just tell us a bit about you, Nicole?
I went to St. Evex. I have a degree in political science, and then I went to University of King's College and did the journalism degree.
Are you a journalist now?
No, I'm not. I worked kind of in local media for a number of years up until the pandemic, really.
Okay.
Different positions.
I feel like a lot of people change their career path when the pandemic begins. When you ask people what they do, many people have like, this is the story, and then when the pandemic...
Right? That's why I don't know how to answer the question, because I'm like, what? Tell me, my last year is not the same person as like what was prior to October 16th, 2020 and the pandemic even beyond. So
yeah, you've had a lot on top of the pandemic. So we're going to be talking about your brother, but before we do, I was going through kind of like, just even like looking at your Facebook photos and your online presence, people will often have a picture of themselves with their sibling or something. But you and your brother Andrew, it seemed to be special. You have a lot of photos. You seem really close. Can you talk a bit about your relationship?
Yeah, Andrew was my best friend. He's only 2 years younger than me. Mm-hmm. So he kind of was all that I knew about life, really, mm-hmm. right? Like, I was 2 years old when he was born. And I always had him, and I always expected that he would be there. So it's very strange now, but he was just the most amazing person, like, had the kind of energy I always say, like, he had like kind of energy, he'd go to the dog park and be like swarmed by dogs because dogs know energy so well, and like he just had that energy that radiated like so wonderfully everywhere he went. He had the kind of laugh that it would steal the thunder of any joke because he's so freaking funny the way that he laughs, and mm-hmm. I don't know, there's so many different things to admire about him and just the kind of person that he was and how genuine and authentic and loyal, like the best kind of friend possible. Mm. So I lucked out big time.
Yeah. And now we'll get into this more as we go, but nowadays you're very much serving as his advocate for what happened. Growing up, were you as the big sister, was it like you're looking out for him like throughout life, or was he kind of the big little brother?
I think it was both. We definitely both had our opportunities to have to stand up for each other, but that's what we did because we were best friends. Like, I remember being in high school numerous occasions and having to go to the bullies and be like, no, not my brother. So, and he did the same for me. Like, I remember him standing up to a boyfriend of mine in high school because the boyfriend was being an arsehole and my brother was like, so I think it was a little bit of both all the time. We always had each other's backs, no matter what.
So when he wasn't entertaining you and laughing with you and protecting you or being protected by you, what were his hobbies? What was he into?
He's an engineer, so he's like super smart and liked to build things. Like he just bought a house, so he built a full new fence around his backyard for his dogs. He loved his dogs, and he loved boating. He loved the water. Ironically, like, he loved his friends. He loved a good casino night. He loved to go spend money at the casino. But he was so smart in everything that, you know, he could kind of be an idiot at a casino every once in a while.
Yeah, that's fair. That's
fair. So, I don't know. I guess that kind of sums it up.
Yeah.
Like, I could go on forever about just...
You mentioned he was an engineer. What did you know about his job? Like, I hear engineer, I have no idea what that means because it seems like an engineer is a million things.
Yeah.
What is Andrew's job?
So he was a civil engineer. And honestly, I don't really know that much about it. I probably learn more about it now at this point in time because we'd always talk about it, but it's one of those things where he's like dropping all these words and I'm like nodding along. Yeah. Like, I get it, but I'm happy for you, you know? So, but his job on the site that day, like he was kind of the data collector, like the numbers guy of the operation, right? So he like did a lot of that kind of work, I guess. They would go to these sites, collect certain data, and then he would go back and analyze the data, and that was kind of his role more so.
Mm-hmm. And the way I understand it is he was living in and stationed out of New Brunswick, but his work would lead him to different sites across the East Coast?
Maybe? Yeah, they were contracted out by a number of different companies, I guess. So, like, in this case, Nova Scotia Power. So he lived in Rosay, which is where we grew up, and then was here working that day.
And you were living in Halifax when this happened a year ago. So how, like, when he be in Rothsay going to the different sites and whatnot, how often would you have been in touch with him around this point? Like, was it the kind of thing where you would call each other once a week sort of thing?
Yeah, he would call me every time he was just driving in his car to one of these sites and bored by himself. Like, we talked all the time. Yeah. So we were talking, like, the day before.
Okay, so, yeah. But you didn't know he was in
Nova I didn't Scotia. Know he was in Nova Scotia, no. Okay. It was just one of those, like, they'd get in the car, they'd come up, they had a job down in Lunenburg to do, I think they stayed the night there, and then they drove up to Sheet Harbor the next day for the job, and we were supposed to go home, so. Actually, I think there was another site they were supposed to go afterwards, but.
Okay. So, how did you learn something happened to him at work? Because I understand you were one of the first people that the news got to.
Well, yeah, so, one of his managers went to his house, and his girlfriend at the time was there, and she was the one that ended up calling us.
Oh. So she would have got the news right from the boss?
She got the news from the manager, and then my parents were camping at the time, they were in Fundy Park.
Okay.
And so I think they were trying to get a hold of them at home, but couldn't, and so they went right to his house, and so my parents got the word from his girlfriend as well.
Okay. And did you talk to his girlfriend, or did you talk to your parents?
I talked to his girlfriend.
She just, like, phoned you? What did you learn at that point?
It was a pretty horrendous phone call. She really didn't have it very well together, obviously, at that point in time with that news. So it was just, like, screaming on the phone. And at that point, I was like, Why, I don't know why she would be calling me screaming. I'm like, well, what happened to my brother? Obviously something's happening to my brother. And she just couldn't even get it out. And eventually I was like, hey, tell me what is going on. Like, stop screaming. And she did. And then we went from there.
Was she able to tell you what had happened?
She just said there was an accident. So we didn't know. Like, all we knew was that Andrew was missing, really, at that point in time. And, like, my parents were got in the car and were rushing up to Sheet Harbor, and my mom was calling me saying, like, put on, like, a bunch of warm clothes, like, Andrew's missing, like, it's gonna be a long night, assuming that we're, like, gonna spend the night in the woods looking for him or something. And I was able to get a hold of his boss, who was on his way to Sheet Harbor as well, and he told me that it didn't sound like we should have any hope. He kind of explained to me what had happened, and, like, he definitely wasn't missing. Like, they'd seen him go under the water, so... Mm-hmm.
Talking now about the present day, we know quite a bit more about what was going on there and what happened, but after talking to his boss and when you were going there, what did you know? Like, what was the story they told you of what happened?
Well, so, at that point, all I knew was that they were doing this job, the equipment malfunctioned, Andrew went in the water, and he didn't come back up. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even know where it was in Sheet Harbor, so... my parents were rushing up there. I don't know Sheet Harbor. It was getting close to dark at that point in time, so I was just planning on staying put until my parents got there, at least. Because we didn't even have any contact with the RCMP at that point, so I figured I was probably more helpful actually staying here and trying to figure out what was going on than rushing in my car.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I sat here and, like, called every hospital and every, like, RCMP detachment, because I'm like, maybe he ended up somewhere else, like, trying to figure out anything. And that's when I came across the Nova Scotia Power Dam and, like, started to put it together that it was the Nova Scotia Power Dam that he was working at in Sheet Harbor. And I couldn't find anything else, but CTV had the press release from the RCMP, and in it they said worker fell in the water. And then they changed it very soon after to say worker entered the water. Honestly, it was, like, by that point, like, within hours of the accident, I thought automatically, like, why would you bother to update that one word unless you were already trying to be like, he did that himself. That's his fault.
When did they find him or discover where he was?
So that night, my parents got to Sheet Harbor. Their friends went with them, and they went to the hospital and talked to the guy that was with him. And they kind of heard the same story that I'd heard from his boss on the phone prior. And my dad called me, and he was like, he didn't make it. Like, they're sending divers in the morning. So we knew that there was a pretty good chance. But I still remember trying to be so optimistic because my brother was, like, the toughest, strongest dude. Like, in my head, I was like, if anybody is going to come out with, like, a crazy story about fighting a bear in the woods in Sheet Harbor, it's going to be my brother. So there was a huge part of me that still wanted to be kind of optimistic. But they sent the divers in, and they took out the guy who was with him, his worker, and they took him out on a boat, and they said they got him to drop the buoy, and they found him pretty much right there. But again, if he was right there and you knew he went right down, why did it take you 24 hours to find him? I don't understand.
The identification, who was it, your parents that did that? They just
the three of us were at the motel, and we had to go to the site when they found him, and I was too busy throwing up in a ditch to pull it together and go and...
In your face. Wow.
They did that.
That seems unusual. I wouldn't expect it to have been done that way.
I don't know.
That just seems so traumatic.
Yeah. It was very traumatic for all of us, for sure. I will never forget the image of my crying parents walking away from a forensic police truck. You know?
On a night cold enough to freeze your bones, a prospector searching for a legendary cursed gold mine vanishes without a trace. I'm Crew Williams, the host of Dead Man's Curse. This season, we retrace the steps of fortune seekers looking for a motherlode worth billions who never came back. Join our quest June 3rd. Search for and follow Dead Man's Curse Volcanic Gold on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
The guy, the coworker that was with him that day, he had a chance to talk in the hospital, as you said. What was his version of the story? Like, how did he describe, or how do you understand his version of what went down?
So he talked to my parents at the hospital, and the story was that he had gotten in the water to go and rescue this piece of equipment that malfunctioned. And so I guess to just explain the piece of equipment, it's bathymetry data survey. See, these are the words that when you talk to me, I'm like, I don't know. But so it looks like a tiny little drone. I guess it actually wasn't that tiny. It's probably like 100 pounds, but it's...
Looks like a tiny boat. The photo I saw, I'd be like, that looks like if a boat and a drone had a baby.
Yeah.
It'd maybe be this thing.
Yeah. Exactly. If you went and grabbed it in the water, you could haul it, right? Mm-hmm. So it malfunctioned. I guess it has fans or motors on either side, and one of them crapped out. So it was just spinning in the water kind of slowly, and he just went out to grab it. And then all of a sudden, he's struggling to swim and calling for help. And so his coworker jumped in the water and swam out to try to get to him, but couldn't. He told me he did breaststroke the entire way to try to get to him and keep his eye on him the whole time, but he couldn't get there. And he made it out to this little island in the middle of the lake or reservoir, I guess, and he was picked up from that island and Andrew was gone.
Wow. Yeah. To get a sense of it, like how far out into the water was Andrew like to get this machine? Like from the shore, do you have any idea?
I don't think it was that far. I know that the little island that Sean made it to, that's his coworker, was like just from tracing it on Google Earth, looks like it's like 100 meters from shore.
Okay.
So somewhere in between that. Mm. So not very far. Mm. But I did talk to like another one of the witnesses that day, and he said like Andrew got in the water and booked it. Like he was out there like that, but he was a really strong swimmer and a really strong guy. So he just started doing front crawl and...
Mm. So eventually what happens is, like in Nova Scotia and probably the rest of Canada, if someone's injured or killed on a work site, there's some sort of an investigation. Was your family involved when this investigation was happening? Like, where he died on the job, people were looking into what happened. Like, what role did your family play initially?
None. Identifying his body. That was it.
Okay.
That was literally it. Like, at the site that day, we got called and they found him. We went up to where the accident was, did the identification. We kind of just stood on the beach there for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's when I was just staring, like, standing on this little beach that he entered the water. Like, I can show you some videos I took just to show you how crazy. Like, it doesn't look dangerous at all. It looks like you'd be going swimming in Long Lake or something. Yeah. And off in the distance, you can see houses and rafts. And clearly, people get in this water all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's mid-October, but it was also temperature like today. Like, mm-hmm. I'm outside walking around in a t-shirt. So he was just like, screw it. I'm going to get in here and go get it.
Yeah, I get that.
Stupid choice. Of course, he would say that now too. But the problem is that should have never been an option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, so we didn't have any involvement in the investigation at all. We did that identification and then we went home, and the expectation is, you know, plan a funeral, do a visitation, and we'll call you at some point in time
and let you know what happened. So I guess you were probably expecting at some point in the near future your family would get some report of, you know, all the details.
Well, we just had no idea what was happening, because the only person that we ever talked to who was official in this process was the RCMP on site that day. Mm-hmm. And so after we left Sheet Harbor, we never heard from anyone.
So this part of it is settled. He is found, he's identified positively to be him, and there's no question that a tragic accident led to his death at this point. You're unsure how the investigation's going to go, but you expect that an investigation will be done. We know now that things get much more complicated. When did you realize that things were going weird, that something wasn't right?
So I believe it was in November-ish. We hadn't heard from anybody yet. So it was about a month after the accident. And I was able to find out that nobody had actually filed his death with WCB. And so WCB went into this big panic and eventually got the department and the person who was supposed to be investigating this in charge with, or in contact with my family. And that would have been like the end of November-ish. So, but it took me going and finding that nobody had filed this with WCB, but yet they said that the other one of the witnesses had filed and was off work on stress, but there was no record of a death at all.
And WCB, just for people who aren't from the area, that's Workers' Compensation Board.
So yeah.
Would they be involved in the investigation, or would they just be involved in, like, paying people who are off work and
stuff? They're just involved in, like, the payout process.
Mm-hmm. But as far as you were able to find out at this point, they didn't even seem to be aware of him dying?
No, and one of the people that we talked to for the first time at WCB told us off the bat that the way that these investigations have gone have caused family to go to media, and just kind of like casually said that to us as we're having one of our first conversations with WCB. So as soon as that guy kind of mentioned that, I started Googling.
Yeah, and you were able to find like multiple families in similar situations, specifically Luke Seabrook.
Mm-hmm.
His death is very similar to Andrew's.
It's bizarrely similar. So when Luke died in 2015, the department did a very similarly botched investigation, his mom, Angela, thought. And so she tried to file a claim against Nova Scotia Power herself because the department didn't find them guilty. They only looked at Luke's direct employer.
Mm-hmm.
So she tried to file herself. But under the investigation, the Federal Investigations Act, you have to be within a year. So she had to go back to court and like fight that she didn't know that they weren't looking at Nova Scotia Power so that she could get her negligence claim time extended. And it was a whole battle. But because she'd done that and gone to the media about that, I knew that I only had the year to work within this process.
Mm-hmm.
But right after Luke died, this guy, I don't know if I should say, I don't know how much. Okay, well, yeah, I guess I can say. So this guy named Steve Donovan, he's a dam safety and dive safety expert, I guess is more appropriate. But he contacted Angela Seabrook after Luke died, and he saw it in the news, and was really concerned about a lot of the different dam safety issues and dive safety issues, because Luke Seabrook was a diver, so the situations are a little bit different. But so Steve started to do a report into Luke Seabrook's death at the Nova Scotia Power Dam. And then after this kind of happened with Andrew, I got in contact with Steve, and Steve basically like laid out all of the issues that arose with Luke's accident and the investigation to follow. And I mean, they're very similar to all of the things that are happening in Andrew's accident now. So,
Was it like reading about like, say, Luke Seabrook's or these other deaths? Do you think that maybe is what made you be like, you know, this is going to get ugly and I need to be on my toes? Because what I'm trying to understand is right now, it's like you are serving as your brother's advocate, lawyer, and a whole bunch of other things, it seems, and also are like an expert now in these engineering terms. at what point was it where you're like, you know, I gotta get on my toes with this?
I think but literally by November, I was downloading like climate reports and like water levels and all of that kind of stuff, just collecting any piece of information I possibly could about it. And, you know, it went from a point of, like, I was just trying to understand for myself, but then I realized that I needed to save all of this stuff. So it was really quickly off the bat that I started to build that Google Drive and just started to save everything in it. But, like, in the beginning, I'm doing things like, I was reading a study from the 90s about the smelt populations in the river because the smelt were being impacted by the dams. So to learn how the dams were working, I'm sitting there reading about these smelt studies.
Oh my gosh.
So, like, yeah, it got, like, it's been a lot, and right off the bat. Mm-hmm. So, and it just ended up so twisted so quickly that the more that I looked, the more it was like, oh my God, I can't stop looking because this is crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's as we go, you'll see it seems like every step of the way you're just uncovering something that makes it look worse.
I sat on this couch night after night after night and would like find something crazy, and like I'm surprised there's not like a literal track around here, because I'd be like pacing like, holy shit, what are they doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, let's get into that. I think what maybe when I went through the timeline, it seems one of the first things that came up was the idea of the conflict of interest with the investigator. So first of all, this investigator that we're going to talk about, they didn't work for the Workers' Compensation Board, did they? Like, who was this investigator?
The Department of Labor does the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So So Courtney Donovan was the name of the investigator, the lead investigator, and she is apparently the only person that does or collects any information on this. And then she takes all of the findings of her investigation to her boss, and the two of them will go to the prosecutor and have this conversation about what charges they're going to recommend. So Courtney, the only person collecting information on this case whatsoever, is blatantly a former Amera employee in safety.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that was right on her LinkedIn.
What led to you figuring out her prior employment in this possible conflict of interest? Like, at what point were you like, you know, this investigator's, something's up, I'm gonna...
She was not very caring at all. Like, we got her on the phone for the first time, and we were asking her questions about what was happening in the process, and all she had to say was, we have 2 years to do our investigation. And this woman's clearly, like, on her lunch break. You can hear the breeze, like, as she walks down the street. Like, you're not even sitting in front of any, like, documents or anything. Like, this is so nonchalant for you, and this is huge for us.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, I asked if they were going to be looking at the bruises on his face, and she wouldn't say yes or no at all. And she said, that's part of the investigation, it's private, blah, blah, blah. And we're like, it's not a secret, though, because we saw them. So are you going to look at them or you're not going to look at them? That shouldn't be that difficult of a question to answer at a bare minimum.
Yeah.
So it was after that conversation, I was like, this woman sucks. And so I looked her up on LinkedIn and I was like, oh,
yeah,
that's something.
And what you found, for people who don't know, like, the different companies, is your brother was killed working on an Amera, which is the parent company of Nova Scotia Power, on one of their sites. The person who is investigating it on their LinkedIn, so basically their resume, shows a prior job in the not too distant past. They were a safety coordinator for the company that owns the site that he was killed.
Yeah, some kind of safety officer or something at Nova Scotia Power. It said, yeah, blatantly Amera.
And what I find most troubling is, when you made it known to people, she or someone updated her LinkedIn history to remove that reference to the company that...
So it's weirder.
Okay.
So when I first started calling the Ian Rankin's office and stuff, I was just trying to talk about the quality of the investigation and just like the communication or the lack thereof.
Mm-hmm.
But once I finally started to say, why is the former Amera employee the only one investigating this, was when people actually started to listen. Government people actually started to listen because they were probably concerned.
Uh-huh.
And so she was taken off the case pretty quickly right after.
Interesting. Okay.
And then she cleared her LinkedIn.
And then, okay, convenient.
Wait, okay. And then actually, her Scott Noss, who's like a higher up guy there in charge of this investigation or something, I don't know. There's so many freaking senior bureaucrats in the government. It's impossible. Like, why do you have one investigator looking at these cases, but you have 15 people at the top? It doesn't make any sense. But I asked Scott Noss whether or not they'd reported Courtney to the commission to actually declare whether or not it was a conflict of interest or if it was just a perceived conflict of interest and it's fine. And they never did that. And they promised me that they would, but they obviously made the decision themselves to just take her off and never reported it at all. And then Scott Noss told me that she'd been taken off of all Amera and subsidiary related cases and refused to tell me where that decision came from. But I'm like, how many Amera related cases is she on?
Yeah.
That she's, you're telling me this now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So...
Now, another thing you had said earlier is you confronted the investigator about bruises to Andrew's face or damage to Andrew's face. So first of all, tell me how you learned about his face being damaged in a drowning. Like, was that something your parents saw when they identified the body?
They did. Like, they did get a warning from the RCMP that he had, like, gotten a little bit of damage to his face. And so they, like, the RCMP on site seen it. My parents seen it. And then during the wake or the viewing, I guess, they warned our family, like, before we went in, that he'd had pretty substantial damage to his face and it couldn't have all been totally repaired. And, like, I couldn't even go in the room because this was already so traumatizing that I was like, damage on top of this. Like, I don't want to see that. Mm-hmm. And, like, eventually I did, and so I know what was there. But it looked like, you know, somebody had a really, really bad bruise, and somebody tried really hard to cover it up with makeup, as they do, and it just couldn't be. Mm-hmm. And so, even like, everybody acknowledged the fact that these bruises existed.
There was no doubt. Like, he had bruises to his face.
Yeah. 100%. Like, he had, like, damage to his nose and his lip and, like, bruising all over the side of his face.
Mm-hmm. And how does this come into the investigation? Because you challenged the investigator on whether or not they're going to be looking into the bruising on his face. I believe that there comes a point where you begin to suspect that they weren't even aware of this bruising. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, so it was the beginning of March that after calling Lena Diabs, like the Minister of Labor, and Rankin's office and stuff, they finally got me in touch with Scott Burbridge, who's the Manager of Investigations at the Department of Labor. And in that conversation, I knew they'd totally screwed up, but that was the conversation where, you know, he told me that they were only looking at the two companies involved and that they had nothing against the power company and that there were absolutely no injuries to his face and just saying like all these crazy things. So when he denied that, I asked for the autopsy report myself and I got a copy of it. And in it, it didn't have any mention of the bruising to his face. It had like a very vague mention of a slight pink abrasion, I believe was the wording. And it only mentioned like the injuries to his nose and lip, but it didn't say anything about bruising. And the dates of the accident and summary of the full events was wrong on the autopsy report. So they weren't looking at the right day. And they didn't even note the injuries in the autopsy report. So I then got in contact with the medical examiner's office and fought with numerous people over there and eventually got them to amend the autopsy report, and they changed it and sent out a new one within 24 hours. And I mean, I'm realizing now that their amendments to it were probably to satisfy what I thought was happening at that point in time and wasn't. It's still to date not true, because now I've gotten to the point where I looked at the pictures for myself to be like, did you, like, could they have missed it or could they not have? And if the province's medical examiner looked at that face and said there's no injuries to it, then we have a big freaking problem.
Yeah, because you got the copies of photos from like the autopsy or whatnot, that so you see it in his face.
It's very clear.
Yeah. So, and just to recap, is when you get the autopsy to review, you find that it doesn't mention the bruises that you know exist and saw in the photos. Secondly, the date was flawed.
Well, I didn't look at the photos until actually like just last month.
Oh, really?
To confirm like some things. But yeah, so at that point, it just wasn't mentioned in the like word doc.
But regardless, without the photos, you knew it was there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then as far as the date of death, because this will become important, tell me about what it said on the autopsy for the date of death and maybe how they came to that day.
Right. So when, I guess your date of death is officially when they find you. Mm-hmm. So his date of death was October the 17th. Technically, but he died on the 16th, the afternoon of. And in the summary of events on the autopsy report, it says that the accident happened on the 17th and he was found a couple of hours later. Mm-hmm. But what is significant about that is that the dam was turned off to assist the searchers in the process, but it was on when he was working. Mm-hmm. And it's quoted by the Halifax Fire in some of the news stories that were coming out that the dam, Nova Scotia Power, turned the dam off to assist with searchers. So obviously between missing the bruising and then having the dates wrong that showed the day that the dam was off, like how?
It's just, it's crazy to have, for there to be a mistake anyway, but in this case, those two mistakes can have a huge impact on trying to interpret what must have happened or what may have happened.
Yeah, and it's the medical examiner's job to determine or to look at the manner of death, too. Mm-hmm. So he just wrote drowning and then closed the book. Mm-hmm. And I brought this up with Scott Burbridge, the investigator, like 2 days prior. Mm-hmm. And so he was fully aware that I had these concerns, that this autopsy report was wrong. They spoke to the medical examiner's office within that period of like 2 days. And then the next day, the medical examiner changes the autopsy to match what I thought was going on at that time. Mm-hmm. So it looks like to me, the department and the medical examiner had a conversation, said, this is what she thinks is going on. And this is like, you could probably change this piece of it, satisfy her and get her to shut up. But then it was like, well, why can you change an autopsy report? Like, why was it wrong?
And just to explain maybe some of the problems with these two facts. First of all, there's a question of how he ended up in the water, and the bruising to his face may have some...
Well, it's not a question of how he ended up in the water, because he got in the water.
Yeah, how he ended up under the water.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's it.
How does the bruising come into play? Like, what could the bruising
tell?
Well,
at first, I thought that maybe he had gotten hit in the piece of, by the piece of equipment in the head or something, and that caused him to be disoriented. So it was either that's what happened, or the dam was on, and so that caused him to go under. And so it was literally either one of those two things would clarify a lot, but they were both missing.
And for like the dam being on, meaning like the dam would be open, so water, some water would be going through it, which would create like an, I think it's called undercurrent, where the water would kind of pull you under.
Well, like it's a hydro dam, right? So if there's not a current in the water, then Moses Power should probably shut them all down, right? Like,
yeah.
So yeah, and I think that, you know, you when you're working under these circumstances, you you would never put people in the water at that point in time. Like, from what I've gathered, that's peak power consumption time. So that's when people are, you know, consuming power the most. That's when these things are operating at their prime. So you shouldn't even be putting people to work in these waters.
So, and so now just to get back to the autopsy is, without knowledge of the bruising, it would be really hard to figure out if the dam, if the pressure pulled him under because the dam was open or the equipment hit him.
If he had bruises on his back or something, I don't think we'd be here today. But it's because I saw those bruises that really kind of tipped this whole thing off.
We've gone through enough where we know you found big problems and errors within the initial investigation and didn't seem to be getting anywhere with it. Tell me a bit about the avenues you took and the steps you took to escalate your concerns, both in terms of media and politically.
I tried to talk to everybody I possibly could. Like, I called the minister's office, I called the premier's office, I called the oppositions, I called the labor oppositions, I talked to the Federation of Labor. Like, I literally talked to everybody I friggin' could about this, and I couldn't find one person who was gonna say, I'll help you.
When you say you talked to the oppositions, do you mean like you were calling people representing the government in power and then representing, and then called the other political parties?
Yeah, I've talked to all the labor oppositions. I tried, because it's like, what am I supposed to do? Like, one of you has to be able to say something, right?
Yeah.
So I talked to everybody.
Wow. Yeah. And what did you get out of it? Other than a whole bunch of phone calls and mounting frustration.
Just, like, at first it was just like passing off me off to the next person and the next person and the next person. And I just, every time I'd talk to somebody else, I'd call Ian Rankin's office back and be like, I want to talk to you, not the people making the problems.
And Ian Rankin was our premier at the time?
Yes.
Yeah, well, it gets kind of complicated because he was your MLA
yes.
when Andrew died, but he became the premier.
Yes. And so I thought when he became premier, I was like, great, fine, my MLA is the premier. He'll just go in and freaking fix this.
Yeah.
Not the case. Not the case at all.
No. So you went through all levels of government, basically, and the different parties involved in this. You were getting nowhere, but it seemed to get even worse than that, where I understand, looking at your Twitter and reading some of the articles and stuff, you were just like kind of just trying to arrange meetings with the premier and just showing up at the office. Is that what happened?
I have. I've done everything I possibly can. I've gone to his office on numerous occasions, and I've like talked to his secretary, and I've sent many emails and phone calls, and I had to put my number on blocked calls for a period of time because they don't answer my phone calls.
Oh, my.
And, I mean, like, they even went so far as to call my parents and to tell them that I was emailing too much and impeding the investigation. Like, just answer once. Answer one question once.
Yeah.
And you could have gotten rid of me, but you never answered one.
Yeah. And I read a lot of the emails because you shared with me a lot of the documents. And the emails you sent, they were, yes, they were pointed questions, but they made sense and they were logical. And I truly agree. I believe and agree with you that I think they didn't want to answer them because the answers were damning or...
Yeah.
Because
the questions I was asking was like, why did Courtney Donovan end up in this position in the first place? Mm-hmm. Where did she go? Like, why did you tell me blatantly that you didn't look at Nova Scotia Power? Why were there issues on an autopsy report? Like, these are not unreasonable questions.
Yeah, yeah. You weren't just trying to hurry them along. You were, yeah. Now, we use the word hostile to describe you a few times. People listening may not get the inside joke there. How did you find out they were referring to you as hostile?
In the Freedom of Information request that I put in. So they'd stopped talking to me after I went to the media, pretty much. Mm-hmm. They cut communications and they passed me off to the Department of Justice and said I wasn't... At first I wasn't allowed to talk to the Department of Labor, only the Department of Justice. And then I wasn't allowed to talk to the government at all for a period of time. But it was right after I went to the media that he was emailing the higher-ups in the Department of Labor saying...
Who is he?
He is Scott Burbridge.
Okay.
Yeah, the manager of investigations.
Yeah.
Yeah, he in that... So they stopped talking to me. I filed the FOI asking for internal communications with my name on them to figure out what they were saying about me to have gotten to the point that they're no longer speaking to me. And within that, he... It was right after the CBC News story came out. I sent him a text and I just asked him if he could send... me the files so I could just do it without having to sift through lies on top of it all. And then he emailed all his higher ups and said, this is a hostile individual who's launched a now public attack and I would like permission to, I don't know. It's like, it was so stupid. Like the way that he talked about me was like militant level kind of thing.
Wow.
You know, like.
Interesting. Now, one other thing we haven't kind of explained is, the different parties involved in Andrew's work and ultimately in Andrew's death, because Andrew didn't work for Nova Scotia Power.
Mm-hmm.
He worked, and correct me if I'm wrong or explain this better when I finish. Andrew worked for an engineering company out of New Brunswick. Nova Scotia Power needed some work done. So Nova Scotia Power, who owned the site, hired some company who subcontracted it to Andrew's employer.
Yeah. So... From what I understand, like Nova Scotia Power is the site owner. They needed to have this work done. They're doing their hydro dam refurbishment projects right now. So it's like, it's a big project. So they contracted out this one, I think they're like Gemtech is the middle company. And then they contracted out my brother's company to come in and do like this specific data collection.
Okay.
So they're kind of all like involved in the job process.
Mm-hmm. So without jumping too far ahead, when you're looking for answers and accountability in this, where do you see Nova Scotia Power and Emera's responsibility? Like where is it within the story that you think they should have intervened in some way?
It's the total, like, the operation of their sites in general. Like, they didn't have a pre-site meeting, safety meeting. Like, the guy that was supposed to be managing the site wasn't anywhere nearby. Like, and, like, going back to the issues with the way that the dams are allowed to operate here, they didn't even have a sign up that said, like, don't go in this water. And, like, since then, I've gone back to the site. And they've put up signs since then. Mm. It's very clear those signs weren't up all winter. They're on 2x4s. Like, the wood's brand new.
Yeah, okay.
So, like...
So, to put it in simple terms, they basically just passed the keys to the dam to, like, you know, your brother and his coworker. Like, yeah, go on in there and take care of things without... You know, having the appropriate...
Even appropriate, like, site orientation, right? Mm. Like, he would be doing this kind of data collection on various different sites. It could be in the woods. It could be on a dam. Mm. It could be anywhere.
Mm.
So, as a site owner, you have the responsibility to make sure that the people you bring onto your job site know what the potential risks and hazards are.
Mm.
And if it got to the point where you know, that piece of equipment did need to be rescued, then you have another meeting and say, okay, here's how we're going to assess this situation. Like, there's just no proper management on these sites because they don't have to.
Mm-hmm. I get that. Yeah. Now, to back up with another thing, we were talking about Ian Rankin was your MLA. So you were going to him at one point as your MLA for assistance. He became premier. You were then, again, still involved with him when looking for assistance when he was premier. And presumably,
and just
had
for, like, for the record straight, Rankin's talked to me one time out of all of this. So.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
What I was going to get at, and I don't know how comfortable you are talking with this, but this story has, it is political in the way that there's bureaucratic people and government involved in the investigation and whatnot, but you almost got pulled into it politically as well. Are you okay talking about that?
100%. And I've given him a grace period and told him over and over again, this does not look like a stellar performance on your part either.
Because this, a lot of this story with your search for accountability and answers and Andrew's death happened, or were playing out as we had a provincial election.
Yeah.
So you were publicly, you had a problem with the leader of our province, Ian Rankin, at the time, and you, but you were also going to the opposition, the people who were running against Ian Rankin in the election that was happening at the time that you were searching for answers. So how did this all happen?
Yeah, it was, so I first talked to Tim Houston and Gary Burrell first. They called me as soon as the first story came out in CBC.
So these are the other leaders of the parties that would have been involved in this election that happened.
Yeah. So they called me, and that would have been, but that would have been prior to the election. I talked to them for the first time. And then, I guess it was all prior to the election. So he called me and asked if I would run against Rankin, and, you know, kind of propositioned it as being a really great opportunity for me to get this change and get my story out there. And, you know, he said it's a hard seat, but you might be able to give him a run for it, like, blah, blah, blah. And was just so excited to have Ian Rankin find out that I was considering this. And at one point in time, I did say, yes, I considered it. And I was thinking about it. And I'm like, okay, well, if Ian Rankin won't talk to me, maybe I do just say yes and go and fight him along the whole campaign trail. But I couldn't get Tim Houston to ever once say, I'm going to help you with this, or ever publicly say, I'm going to support you on this. So it got to the point where it was like, why am I never going to put my name behind you if you're not going to tell me that you're going to help me with this? And so I said, absolutely not.
Yeah. It's like, I'm almost speechless. When you told me about that, I was, I'm almost speechless still to this day about it. But it's, an election was happening. One of the leader of the party that's now in power encouraged you to run against the prior leader in this area as a way of further, like, was there ever like,
well, he propositioned it that way. Like, he was like, this would be like a great platform, like you can make a lot of change, and like what, like kind of tried to sell it that way. Yeah.
Okay.
And I, yeah, didn't agree.
Wow. And then in the end, you didn't do it. You haven't gotten any support. It's like,
yeah, no, he, well, I mean, it's, I also am not naive enough to believe that a PC government is going to come in and take on a company like Nova Scotia Power in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I told him I absolutely was not going to do that, and then he never talked to me again. And I was irritated by it because I also gave him the opportunity, because I said to him at one point in time, like, he'd seen all my emails, he'd heard my conversations with Ian Rankin, and I said, like, what is your play here? Because this is a weird play. Mm-hmm. So what do you want me to come in and run my mouth against Rankin and then make him look like a dummy throughout the election, and then you can at the end help me with this, like, whatever it takes, I will do it. And he just kind of like laughed it off, whatever. And it was very interesting. Like, there was like no, like, he's fully aware of the full scope of the issues. Mm-hmm.
Well, it just shows how much is against the truth from coming out and the accountability. And then it's like you get involved in politicians in the political world more than the average person, much more than the average person who's trying to get accountability. And not only do you not get anywhere, that you almost get sucked into this whole thing like that's kind of what you get in return for going for help, is almost get sucked into this whole thing.
Yeah.
It's bizarre. So without giving away too much, is I'm willing to say you feel like accountability and an answer in this is being taken away or hidden for some reason. Who is hiding the truth, and why do you think that's happening? Or maybe not the truth, but who is avoiding accountability in your mind?
I feel like it comes down to probably the government. Mm-hmm. Because really they should have done better when Luke died. And mm-hmm. there's now the report out that shows like all of the failings that they had in that case.
Do you feel like you're on one side of the table, on the other side of the table you have Nova Scotia Power, the province? Who else do you feel is like kind of like against you and Andrew?
The medical examiner. He mm-hmm. creeps me out. Mm-hmm. Like, there is no reason to have made those mistakes. And he's the only one at the end of this can call the fatal inquiry. Like, he's mm-hmm. the one that can put pressure on the government to do that. And I don't want that guy leading a fatal inquiry. I want that guy to be inquired yeah. upon. Like, those errors are not acceptable from the medical examiner's office.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking at this, everything you've been through in the last year, in terms of not considering the grief, but just in terms of the battles you've had to wage, what do you think, like, if Andrew can see what you're doing, like, what would he think of the efforts and lengths you've gone through to try to get accountability?
There's been so many moments where, like, I just sit here and feel like I can, like, almost hear him, like, he had the incredible laugh I was telling you about, but, like, scream laughing, you know? Just, like, you should not have messed with my sister when it comes to me. Yeah. And I just know that he'd see nothing but loyalty and love in this situation. And I feel like he'd do the same for me.
Your motivation, if you had to describe it, is it justice for the loss of your brother? Is it Nova Scotia Power to correct, you know, the way they do things going forward? Like, what's motivating you to spend so much of all of your free time fighting this?
Is just knowing that had they done the right thing when Luke died, that Andrew could be here. Mm-hmm. So if they did the right thing now, then who else are we saving? Mm-hmm. And so I feel like, for me, I can't stop, because it's such a clear and fixable problem. Mm-hmm. And so until it gets fixed, I'm just...
As far as the battle and fixing things, well, actually, when I prepared this question yesterday, it was going to be what comes next. But I also read the news yesterday, and I think I know what's coming next. So mm-hmm. what's new?
So it's we filed the lawsuit the other day, right the day before the 1 year when we had the chance to. It's kind of crazy that you only have a year to file that claim, and they have 2 years to do their investigation. So you have to make the decision without really even knowing what they did, right? So I think that, like, the way that it's set up just allows them to be totally negligent in their investigation process, right?
Oh, hell
so,
yeah.
Yeah. And even down the road, like, when they take the charges to court, the family can then file for a Freedom of Information request and get access to the information surrounding the investigation that resulted in those specific charges that came out in court.
It's your family versus... And who is the lawsuit filed against?
The Department of Justice and the Department of Labor.
Okay.
Yeah, so both.
Okay. For being negligent in his death or in the investigation?
In the investigation
okay.
process. Okay. Yeah. It's complicated.
I want to ask you if this is... Throughout the year of you doing all this, getting back to the beginning of our discussion, you've lost your brother, a best friend. How do you deal with his death and the grief associated with it while all this other stuff is going on? Like, has there even been a time where you could just sit down and grieve your brother without, you know, being in your battle armor for all this other stuff?
Not really. No. I don't think at this point in time. Like, I think that there's going to come a point where, like, I'm kind of actually scared of when that point in time is where it's like, okay, this is real. But, like, when it, like, I definitely had a good cry yesterday. It was the 1 year mark, and I didn't think that it was gonna hurt. But what really hurts is knowing that now it's two. Everything's two, mm-hmm. right? So it's weird. And like my little brother is my only sibling. Like I think of things like, you know, my grandfather's sick in the hospital right now. And so my dad's taking care of him. And I just think like down the road, like, and my dad's there with his brother, right? And it's just like everything in my life going forward is going to be without him. Like I have to deal with everything. And I have to hope that I'm the last one standing in my family, so my parents never have to watch another kid die again, right? Like, it's such a weird reality to be in, to be like, I know for a fact that one day I need to be the last person standing here. Like, I don't know. And even when we were, like, buying the grave plots, maybe, I don't know. Maybe this shouldn't be true. But as we were buying the grave plots, my dad's, like, joking, like, can we get, like, 3-for-1 special here because we're going to buy the 2 next to it? And I'm like, oh my God. Like, and it makes sense, right? Because like, that's what you have to do. These are the kind of things that you have to face when you someone dies, but obviously like they want to be there with him one day. And I'm like, holy shit, if no one marries me, what's going to happen? Like, I'm going to be like sitting on the bench that you guys have placed here or something. Like, get 4 spots.
Oh my.
But it's weird, you know, just all the different things that you have to face, like the different realities of it all. It's not nice at all.
Mm-hmm. With losing someone so young and at the beginning of life, what was that like? For his friends and family?
It was hard, and it was even harder because it was during COVID, and all my family's from out west, so we basically had no family members there. So it was a lot of his friends were there and stuff, and we had a really nice celebration of life. I hate calling it that because there's... I don't know, celebration and anniversary, they sound like happy terms, and these things are just so not happy, but we called it a celebration of life, and we had it in his backyard that he loved, and they put up, like, thousands of lights, and they had, like, 20 different fire pits, and, like, a bunch of different drinks, and fireworks, and, like, barbecue, and they just kind of, in his backyard, like, one of his last posts on social media was of his backyard, and it just said, like, my happy place, so... Wow. We kind of just set it up as all of his favorite things and had like a really nice, really nice outdoor party for it. But like the funeral and stuff was weird. Like having to do that eulogy was freaking bizarre, especially like he'd bought an engagement ring. So I'm planning to be the best like MC at a wedding possible. And then all of a sudden I'm writing a eulogy. And so it's weird.
Mm-hmm. For people listening that want to support you, support Andrew, is there anything that people can do that would help?
I think that the more that we talk about how big this problem is really it, you know, like, I don't know, write to your MPs, your MLAs, literally anyone, like, just put it on people's radars because, I mean, this is... not a story that I thought I was going to ever be involved in. You know, it could happen to anybody. Andrew was an engineer. It's not like he was doing a dangerous job. It's not like he was out, like, I don't know, you know, like he was not doing anything dangerous. You'd never expect that kind of stuff to happen, right? So I just think that, like, it needs to be put more on the radar that these things are happening, and they're happening because the government's not doing their job to keep people safe in the first place in even the most simple ways, like requiring a sign at a dam. Like, and, you know, like, the problem really is, too, like, the department's supposed to be going to all of these job sites and checking them and doing, like, safety checks and et cetera, et cetera. They never do any of those. Like, you can look up stories online where it's, like, the number of actual times they go out to job sites is so few. So they are kind of negligent in the first place because they don't go and check on anything ever.
For people who want to stay up to date and everything that's going on, I follow you on Twitter and you're very active to share developments. Is there anywhere you would suggest people go or do to follow along with what's going to happen next?
I don't know. I feel like I'm so day by day in how this is whole thing has been happening, right? Like, I don't have a plan. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen with the lawsuit. I'm literally just like, I feel like since the day that Andrew died, it's just been a process of like dealing with everything like day by day, hour by hour, and like not getting too far ahead of myself or overwhelmed. And so I don't know where things are going to go. I do know, though, that I'm not going to back down on this.
I want to thank you for joining Nicole and I in our discussion surrounding her family's tragedy. Although Nicole and I spoke at length here, There's even more to this story than we didn't get into. I've added links to a variety of past news articles that'll give you even more detail on this story. But as you heard Nicole say during our discussion, she's far from giving up. I'm sure there's a lot more of this story to come. And with that, I'll wrap up this episode of Nighttime, but before we part, I'm going to give some thanks. First, a big thank you for Nicole Nizdowski for sharing an evening with me and with the listeners of Nighttime. Nicole, if you're listening, I want to personally commend you on the work you've done advocating for Andrew. The amount of frustration and emotion you're being forced to go through is simply horrific. But having sat with you and seen you express your dedication firsthand, I truly believe that there aren't enough bureaucrats in the world to slow you down. Every worker in this province and their families owe you a debt of gratitude, as it's people like you that truly motivate those responsible for protecting others. My hat's off to you. Next, a big shout out to Monty Data for contributing the music for this episode. It's a piece called Noir Tokyo. And lastly, a massive thanks to everyone who listens to Nighttime, as without your interest and your support, this show would be as pointless as it would be impossible. But with that said, keeping the show alive is and has always been an uphill battle. So if you want to help take some weight off the show's back, please listen on the premium feed. For about the price of a cup of coffee, you can keep the show alive and give yourself more of it at patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. And with that said, let me thank the newest subscribers to the premium feed: Ryan, Gisella, Nicole, Blake, Patty, and Caroline. Thank you for your generous support. And for anyone else who'd like to support the show but can't help financially, you can give me a big hand by simply sharing these episodes across social media. If you have any story ideas or if you want to give feedback on the show, find me at nighttimepodcast.com/contact or on social media. I'm using Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And of course, I'm often live on the Nighttime Podcast YouTube channel. So until next time, take care of each other, hug your loved ones tight, and let me know if you see anything weird.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.
Showcase.
You were in a concentration camp in World War II.
I was a young man, locked up in a terrible place.
Based on the international best-selling book.
But I found something there. Someone.
We must keep living. Whatever it takes.
The Tattooist of Auschwitz. All new, Sundays, on Showcase. Stream on Stack TV.